This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Ondaatje, is probably best known as the author of the novel The English Patient, which was made into a rather popular film a few years ago. But Ondaatje has actually published more books of poetry than fiction and has a new collection just out called Handwriting. Ondaatje was born in 1943 in Ceylon, now called Sri Lanka, an island at the southern tip of India. One of his books is a nonfiction account of his parents' lives there called Running in the Family. When he was 19, he moved to Canada with his mother, where he's lived ever since. Newsweek once described Michael Ondaatje as looking like a cross between Paul Newman and Zeus, and to continue that metaphor on my own, he writes like a god who's also a hustler, always leading you in one direction while arriving at a different, pleasantly unexpected place. I asked him to begin by reading the first poem in his new collection, A Gentleman Compares His Virtue to a Piece of Jade.
The enemy was always identified in art by a lion. And in our book of victories, wherever you saw a parasol on the battlefield, you could identify the king within its shadow. We began with myths and later included actual events. There were new professions, cormorant girls who screamed on prawn farms to scare birds, stilt walkers, tightrope walkers. There was always the untaught hold by which the master defeated the pupil who challenged him. Palanquins carried the weapons of a goddess. Bamboo tubes cut in 17th century Japan we used as poem holders. We tied bells onto falcons. A salted water garden in Mihinthale. The letter M, the word thereby. There were wild cursive scripts. There was the two-dimensional tradition. Solitaries spent all their years writing one good book. Federico Tessio graced us with Breeding the Racehorse. In our theaters, human beings wondrously became other human beings. Bangles from Polonnaruwa, a nine-chambered box from Gampola, the archaeology of kettlebells. We believed in the intimate life and inner self. A libertine was one who made love before nightfall or without darkening the room. Walking the Alhambra blindfolded, to be conscious of the sound of water, your hand could feel it coursing down banisters. We aligned our public holidays with the full moon. 3 a.m. in temples, the hour of washing the gods, the formalization of the vernacular. The Buddha's left foot shifted at the moment of death. That great writer, dying, called out for the fictional doctor in his novels. That tightrope walker from Kurunagala, the generator shut down by insurgents, stood there, swaying in the darkness above us.
Thank you. When you write lines like, we tied bells onto falcons, we aligned our public holidays with the full moon, who's the we in that poem?
Well, one of the ways I attempted to write this very informal and personal history of a country where I was born was to take on a voice of we as a populace, as a not a royal we, but a human we that sort of moves from ancient to modern or ancient to contemporary almost. So in a way, a poem like that is a kind of history of a culture that's no longer available to a people. So, I mean, it does move from a kind of a more mythical situation to real events.
The poems in this book, more than many of your earlier ones that I've read, deal very specifically with images and ideas of Sri Lanka or the Ceylon that you remember. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for this emphasis at this point in writing this book?
Well, I think in a way the book I wrote before about Sri Lanka, which was called Running in the Family, which was about really about my family, my father and mother's generation and my grandparents' generation, was in a way a kind of society that seemed to be very cut off from the rest of the country. You know, I mean, they were kind of, if not an elite, they were not very conscious politically. And I've been going back to Sri Lanka a lot in the last few years, and one of the things I wanted to do was write outside the family, to write about the country in different aspects. So the tone is definitely very different. And I didn't want to, you know, retreat back and write a Running in the Family Part 2. So I wanted to write more about a country that's going through a very tragic phase.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that it is has been in a state of war for the last since about 1983,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it has a country that's tragically caught up in a racial, political, religious war that seems almost not that it cannot solve, not that one can solve these things, but that they, from a Western point of view, we always think we can solve political situations in other countries, and here it's, you know, it seems to be a kind of torment that one cannot end this war.
You wrote in that memoir, Running in the Family, that your parents went from being, quote, two of the best known and wealthiest families in Ceylon to my father owning a chicken farm and my mother managing a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the problem there was my father was a very serious drinker, of mythic proportions, as I heard it. And, I mean, he lost all his money and then as a result of that lost his jobs and ended up on a farm that his father had owned. And so it was a very different kind of world that he ended up in. And my mother, after they divorced, moved to England and got a job in England. So the family kind of split up at that point. And,
how old were you at that point?
I guess I was about 5 or 6 when they broke up.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when I was 11, I went to England to go to school, which was a sort of tradition, of a kind of middle-class tradition. If you could afford it, you sent your kids to school in England, and then they would eventually come back after getting their Oxford Blue or Cambridge Blue or something like that, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I suppose, of the generation that did not come back. I had a brother who did not come back and a sister who did not come back. But I do have another sister in Sri Lanka who still is there and who obviously I'm very close to.
Did you ever feel, after you'd grown and begun a career in Canada, that you were a writer in exile?
Well, in the sense that I hadn't really dealt with my past in Sri Lanka, I suppose I hadn't. And during the time when I first started to write poetry, which was poetry about the landscape I was living in, which was Canada at that time, I did feel separate in some ways. And it took a while for me to be able to write about my own family. You know, it was about my third or fourth book of prose that I did attempt to write Running in the Family. And but in a way, I do keep, I have gone back to write about Sri Lanka in this last book. And, you know, I probably will with other ones as well, because it is very much a part of my background. And in a way, the literature hasn't been spoken as much as you know, obviously in other countries. I mean, when I was writing Running the Family, what was very sad was that there was very little written text that I could find, you know, even to the point where people didn't keep diaries or keep journals. And the only histories that existed were kind of memoirs by viscounts or something like that who were there when the English were there.
Why would that be?
I think that was because, essentially, you know, the energy of story, which certainly exists in Sri Lanka, is an oral one. You know, and I think, you know, I mean, if I sat down to a meal, I could get the most fantastic stories,
mm-hmm.
Told to me by uncles and aunts and about anything at all. And these were, this is actually, in a way, Running the Family was an attempt to try and kind of tell those stories in a literary way, to tell them within a book. Mm-hmm. And, but there was never a sense that people could sit down and write a novel. And I think that was quite a, you know, a new thing in some ways.
So did you begin your career as a poet, or did you, when you professionally began a career, were you wanting to be a poet, or did you write prose?
Oh, I wanted to be a poet. I never thought of being a writer until I came to Canada, and, you know, I think it would have been seen to be presumptuous or something. I'm not quite sure what it was, but when I came to Canada when I was 19, I met other writers of my own age, and I began to write. And what I wrote for the first 5 or 6 years was poetry. It wasn't until I wrote a book called The Collected Works of Billy the Kid that I started to include prose within that book. And then from then on, I have written, I guess, 3 novels now and a memoir.
The Collected Works of Billy the Kid is just wonderful. It's one of my favorite of your books. It's more like a novel in the form of a collection of prose poems to me. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that Your prose is often very poetic, and a lot of your poetry has a very prosy conversational tone.
Mm-hmm.
Has this occurred to you?
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm conscious of the difference, but I mean, I think I like to kind of erase the boundaries between genres, whether it's prose and poetry or prose and imaginary interviews or whatever. You know, I mean, I think in a way, when I was making The Collected Works of Billy the Kid, I saw that the thing not so much as a book as a huge wall of collage or something, you know, like a fresco where I could kind of repeat stories which had started off as poems to see them in terms of prose or picture, or if I could have had sound, I would have had sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, it was sort of a frustrated film as well. I wanted to make my Western movie, and I couldn't. And so I made it within the form of a book.
It seems as if you're often attracted to figures of popular myth or popular culture. That the Billy the Kid, another of your books, Coming Through Slaughter, was a novel about the jazz musician Buddy Bolden.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about these figures that it wouldn't automatically occur, I think, to think that a poet from Sri Lanka would be drawn to such subjects?
Well, it's very strange. I mean, when I was a kid in Sri Lanka, we all played cowboys and Indians. I mean, it sounds appallingly bad, you know, taste and you know, absurd politically and socially. But I mean, I'm afraid that existed and it still existed. It's like, you know, genes being the most important thing in European countries, you know. So that was, I guess, the start of it. But I mean, I think I've always been, as a writer, interested in history as much as in writing. And the figures of Billy the Kid, the figures of Bolden were interesting to me in the sense that because they existed in reality, when I began the book, I could in fact do research, I could inquire, and curiosity was the most important thing I needed when I was writing a book. You know, and so I tended to write about things I didn't know when I began the book, so I would learn those as I went along.
Mm-hmm.
So I was learning about politics of range wars and Billy the Kid, or the politics of immigration, when I wrote a book called In the Skin of a Lion.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always also been interested in jazz. So, I mean, jazz was my great passion. I mean, I've said before, the person I really wanted to be was Fats Waller all my life. And as I couldn't play the piano and as I couldn't be Fats Waller, I wanted to write my jazz story, you know. So that's how that began.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the act of starting off with an historical moment or a historical person and trying to discover that person over a period of 3 or 4 years when you're writing a book, to try and catch and, you know, not that you ever catch a person historically, but to try and kind of create, in fact, a portrait of that person by improvisation, I suppose.
My guest is Michael Ondaatje. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and novelist Michael Ondaatje. He has a new collection of poetry out called Handwriting. In the middle of this new book, you have a section called The Nine Sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you to read one section from this long poem, but first, could you explain what the nine sentiments are?
Well, I mean, it's a very abstract term, actually, but I think essentially it is a way of, in love poetry, of rather than writing poems specifically about a person, to talk about aspects of love, to talk about stages of love. I mean, if one studied Indian love poetry very carefully, every time one talked about a certain location, whether it was a beach or a forest or a desert or a stone field, those would start to signal moments of emotion or kinds of emotion in a love story. So that there tended to be various stages of a love relationship, from joy and passion to disturbance to unhappiness to some kind of resolution. So the nine sentiments is really to kind of catch the aspects of love at various times. And maybe I should read one or two of those.
Yes, please.
Sentiments.
Thank you.
The pepper vine shaken and shaken like someone in love. Leaf patterns. Saffron and panic seed on the lower pillows where their breath met. While she loosened from her hips the string with three calling bells. Her fearless heart, light as a barn owl, against him all night. In another section. an old book on the poisons of madness, a map of forest monasteries, a chronicle brought across the sea in Sanskrit slokas. I hold all these, but you have become a ghost for me. I hold only your shadow since those days I drove your nature away, a falcon who became a coward. I hold you the way astronomers draw constellations for each other in the markets of wisdom, placing shells on a dark blanket, saying, these are the heavens, calculating the movement of the great stars.
Those are really lovely, very sensuous lyric poems. I noticed that in the acknowledgments to the nine sentiments, you say you quote a line from Van Morrison's song, Cypress Avenue.
Right.
I love that song, but I must admit I haven't been able to pick out the line.
The line is, I think, conquered on a car seat.
Uh-huh.
No, but I know which poem that is, and I've forgotten which one it is. I know it's a...
I also noticed that in your 1984 book of poems called Secular Love, you refer to another Van Morrison song, Madame George.
Right. Actually, I think, you know, that two or three regular characters in all my books, one is Fats Waller,
mm-hmm.
one is has become Van Morrison. I noticed the book I'm working on right now, there's some other reference to Van Morrison.
Really?
And I think when I met Anthony Minghella, who was making the film of English Patient, I said, the only person I want you to cast is Van Morrison in some small role so I could meet him. And he's as big a fan as I am, in fact, more so. But I guess in the excitement of making the film, he forgot. I thought he would be a good ambulance driver or something.
Uh-huh. A good grouchy one.
Yes.
Well, since you've mentioned The English Patient, I have to ask you whether the making of that book into what became such a big commercial hit, did it alter your literary life in any kind of significant way? I imagine it must have thrust you into a kind of prominence you hadn't had before.
Well, you know, Canadians, living in Canada, it's a bit easier than living in the States, I suspect. You know, but what I enjoyed about that process was that I did meet people who worked on the film who I admired a great deal, you know, whether they were actors or the director or, you know, someone like Walter Murch, who was the sound editor, who I'd always admired as an editor. And, I mean, I took it as an event where I was going to learn something, learn about the process of filmmaking and learn about editing, which has always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly did change my profile. But the important thing, I guess, was kind of hide back and work on another book.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to your poetry. I wonder if you could read the short poem that's on page 19 of your book called The First Rule of Sinhalese Architecture.
Mm-hmm. Never build three doors in a straight line. A devil might rush through them deep into your house, into your life.
Is this a rule you've actually heard, or one you made up?
No, it's what I heard. I mean, I think a lot of this book is in fact made up in the sense that it's things I've heard and listened to and heard, you know, and discovered in my various journeys and visits in Sri Lanka. I mean, whether it's an old a myth of how one feeds a sick child or how one, you know, avoids certain fears such as this one, or in the first poem I read about a gentleman compares his virtue to a piece of jade, all those images, in fact, do come out of events, to most of them, in terms of Sri Lanka. So that if you look at the statue of a Buddha before his death, you see that the left foot is not quite next to the right foot. And this is because that his left foot does shift at the moment of death. So small images like this make up larger stories in the poems.
I wonder, have you ever written in imitation of other poets you admire or worked in forms that interest you as kind of formal disciplines or exercises, sonnets or, you know, things like that?
No, that's interesting. I haven't. I guess, you know, I suppose when I read a poet or a novelist that I'm very fond of, I don't read them to learn, you know, or I'm sure I'm learning from them, you know, the way one learns from anything good and also learns bad things from something bad. I do learn from them, but for me, it is a kind of unconscious education. You know, so that if I'm reading a novel by DeLillo or someone else, I can... It is, for me, the pleasure of the text, the pleasure of being in that world of that novel. And, is, you know, I'm sure that the influences are there, not necessarily by him, but by the writers. But I don't set out to try and write in the pattern of DeLillo or Hemingway or whoever it is, though I might like them. I think that, you know, makes me feel that I am wearing a mask. And I think, you know, the act of writing for me is such a private one and such a one of difficulty and one of almost reconnaissance of trying to find something in a dark room, that the last thing on my mind is perhaps I can find this by putting on the clothes of a writer I admire. So it is a very private thing, but I'm sure those influences are there, you know. And it's not just writers, too. It's painters or photographers or, you know, swimmers that would influence, you know, a writer, I think.
Michael Ondaatje, I'd like to thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Michael Ondaatje, his new book of poems is called Handwriting. I'm Ken Tucker. This is Fresh Air.